Welcome back to basically the fifth episode of this short series on the history of art. And welcome to the second part on the history of European art from the medieval era to the neoclassical movement. We are going to start with the foremost prime movement of historical art, and that is, of course, the Renaissance. Originating in around 1400 CE in Florence, Italy, the Renaissance rediscovered and redeveloped the art, philosophy, literature, music, and science of classical antiquity. And of course, classical antiquity was the cultural history of the period between the 8th century BCE and the 6th century CE in the Greek and Roman empires. This is basically known as the Greco-Roman period of ancient Europe. Renaissance art encompasses perhaps the most recognizable period of art in human history, with the most famous artists from the period being arguably the most recognizable artists in human history. These include Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, Raphael, Donatello, etc. And of course, the most famous pieces from the period are also arguably the most recognizable pieces in the history of art. This includes the Mona Lisa, the Last Supper, the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, David, one of the Davids, the many David sculptures that were created. There are multiple. And of course, part of the Sistine Chapel, one of the frescoes, the creation of Adam. A style, of course, of the Renaissance will be less emphasized, for the style reflects styles of classical antiquity, styles that have already been analyzed in prior episodes. And also, to be even more specific, we already know for the most part what Renaissance style art is. There's really no reason to necessarily cover it. I mean, it's one of those more common sense topics, because the Renaissance was just such a universally recognizable art movement. But instead of examining the style of Renaissance art, we will focus on the motives for the return to classical art. So instead of focusing specifically on how they created the frescoes or what the sculpture looked like, what the sculpture meant to convey, we are going specifically to look at the origins of Renaissance art. First, classical texts that were lost to European scholars for centuries were rediscovered, reintroducing, of course, Europe to classical art. Europe also gained access to advanced mathematics, a topic that originated with Islamic scholars, but later spread to Europe. Before this period and in this period, movable type printing was developed, allowing ideas to be spread with less difficulty. Actually, around 1440, Gutenberg invented his famous printing press, arguably, and not really arguably, the greatest invention in human history, because it did quite a lot in, first of all, getting the Bible to be spread way further, but also allowing the influential authors and the influential philosophers and specifically the influential rebels to rebel and to spread their ideas more fervently and more easily with less difficulty. And it was not as easy for example, the government or the king, the monarchy, to basically excoriate those ideas without having any excoriation presented back at that monarchy, at that government. So basically, the Gutenberg printing press allowed for everything, because the rebels, they could maximize on that printing press to expand their thoughts to other people, especially people that may not have had access to literature, writing, or philosophical texts before, of course, the printing press was invented. Also, there's the establishment of the Medici Bank, and then, the trade associated with it brought innumerable wealth to Florence, Italy. And this is partly the reason as to why the Renaissance flourished and began specifically in Florence, Italy. Man's relationship with God, humanity, and the universe was not the sole province of the Catholic Church anymore. Is essentially they moved on from just relationship with God, humanity, and the universe. A revived interest in classical culture formulated the first archaeological excavation of Roman remains, which, of course, encouraged the revival of classical architecture, which itself inspired the revival of classical painting and sculpture. The improvement of oil paints and new developments in oil painting techniques by Belgian artists led to the adoption of oil painting by Italy around 1475. And 1440, the Renaissance technically began in 1400, but the Gutenberg printing press was invented well before the High Renaissance. So this was yet another reason for Renaissance, specifically Renaissance literature, being so popular at the time of the creation of this exceptional Renaissance. And then, of course, following the creation and the invention of the Gutenberg printing press. There was what one could call a serendipitous presence of many prodigious artists in Florence, Italy, during the rise of Renaissance culture. Their works led to the rise of the magnificent artists of the High Renaissance and the encouragement of lesser artists to produce works of brilliant and almost unseen quality. And also, there is a serendipitous presence of a number of brilliant artists in Venice that led to a similar heritage of artistic achievement. There is also Leone Battista's, Battista Alberti's two treatises, De Pictura, which is on painting, and De Re Edificatoria, 10 books on architecture, which is translates to 10 books on architecture. So we're going to, of course, go to notable works because there are quite a number of them, and we could, of course, only get the highest, the greatest of the Renaissance, but I assure you that there are way more than them, way more than the ones that I just give in this single episode. But of course, we start off with the Mona Lisa. As the ultimate preeminent portrait in human history, the Mona Lisa is the most expensive and guarded work of art ever created. Arguably Leonardo da Vinci's, not really arguably, greatest work, the Mona Lisa features Lisa del Giocondo, a Florentine noblewoman whose portrait, Mona Lisa, of course, was commissioned by her husband. The Mona Lisa is idealistic, for it resembles Renaissance depictions of the Virgin Mary. A painting of the Virgin Mary is known as a Madonna, so that's just a sidetrack, but yeah, just so you know. The subject appears relaxed and confident, and she sits amongst an imaginary background, which is something that didn't really happen before the Mona Lisa. Mona Lisa was actually one of the first portraits to incorporate an imaginary background. And of course, it added to the grandeur of that portrait, no question. Mona Lisa was not an instantly recognizable piece until the days following August 21st, 1911, when the painting was stolen from the Louvre in Paris by an Italian nationalist who believed that the painting should be on display in its country of origin. Famously, the insurance on the painting was valued. At around $100 million, well before now. It's actually, the insurance is technically valued at $660 million now. But of course, as the painting is essentially irreplaceable, more money was spent on security than on insurance. Because, okay, cool, someone burns it, you can't just get it back. I mean, There's no, you can't really insure something like that. It's not like a couch. Like, you can buy another couch, but you can't buy another Mona Lisa because there's only one Mona Lisa. But of course, there are more. There are more incredible works than just the Mona Lisa. Also, arguably, Leonardo da Vinci's magnum opus, The Last Supper, is a late 15th century painting depicting the Last Supper, of course, or the final meal in gospel accounts that Jesus had with his disciples before his crucifixion. The mural was commissioned as part of renovations of a church, which is Santa Maria del Grazie, which actually is a very... I saw it online and I thought it was a very interesting chapel, church. Sometime... It was commissioned sometime in 1495 or 1496. Little of the Last Supper remains as a result of environmental factors and intentional damage, and meaning World War II. In 1943, the church and the mural were attacked by Allied forces. Of course, World War II, but the mural was protected to prevent any damages. However, the vibration of the blast may have damaged the painting. So, yeah. That's why war is so futile. That's another reason why war is a very futile action, a very futile human action, because it destroys our own culture. Like, this is Western. The Allied forces were destroying Western culture by destroying the Last Supper. When it comes down to it, by attempting to destroy it. When it comes down to it, they were attempting to destroy their own culture, because Western culture and French and American and British culture are quite intertwined. But even so, outside of the war problems, The Last Supper has a history filled with what can only be described as a laughable plethora of irresponsible actions that contributed to its demise as a mural. Below are quite a number of examples of irresponsibility that damaged the mural. I think there's six reasons that I can give, but there are even more on the page that I was reading about it. Of course, link is in the description, Last Supper. First, the church building's restorations, these were the original restorations the mural was commissioned for, were done hastily and with moisture-retaining materials, which subjected the mural to the effects of humidity. In 1652, a door was cut through the mural. I'm not joking. It actually can be seen in the painting as an arch blurring the bottom middle of the painting. It's a semicircle. I'm being as serious as I can. Like, they cut a door through the mural. In 1768, a curtain intended to protect the painting was placed over it, but the curtain trapped moisture on the surface of the mural. When the curtain was removed, the flaking paint was scratched. In 1770, Giuseppe Mazza, largely repainted the entire mural to restore it, quote-unquote, until his efforts were halted due to public outrage. All but three faces were restored by the time the restoration process was halted. So, basically, the painting was just repainted, is essentially what it is. In 1796, French revolutionaries used the refectory as an armory. While occupying the refectory, they threw stones at the mural and scratched out the apostle's eyes. In 1821, Stefano Baresi, an expert in removing entire frescoes from their walls, a renowned expert, attempted to remove the Last Supper, damaging the entire center section before realizing the mural was not a fresco. Subsequently, he attempted to reattach the damaged sections with, and I kid you not, glue. Seriously, that's what happened. So that leads me to a story. So I have this cousin. He was the person I went to. He's the person that I went to Baltimore with, that I vacationed, per se. And I told him about this because he is a huge art fan. He's one of the people that inspired me to get into art. And I told him about this and he had no idea. He's already been to the Last Supper. He's already seen it. And he had no idea that there were those major restoration plans. And I'll say that I could assume that it was not the greatest feeling for him to hear that basically the painting, one of the most renowned paintings in the world, one which he actually went to Italy to see, was basically a fake painting at this point. Basically a fake mural. But of course, it's still created by Da Vinci, it's still historical, so even with all these many blunders, it's still an exceptional work in the end. The ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, this is the next one. It's a large papal relating to the Pope chapel built within the Vatican, or like the Vatican or Vatican City or the Holy See from 1477 to 1480. It features arguably the foremost, like just most impressive work Michelangelo ever created. The Sistine Chapel's ceiling is composed of frescoes that include scenes from Genesis, the first book of the Old Testament, the 12 prophets, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Sorry if I butchered any of those words. I'm not very good at biblical names. Of course, there were the ancestors of Jesus Christ and other biblical figures and stories featured there. Probably the most recognizable fresco on the entire Sistine Chapel ceiling is basically undoubtedly the creation of Adam. It's one of the frescoes on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, and it represents the event in the book of Genesis when God gives life to Adam, the first man, of course. One of the most recognizable murals in the Western world, the creation of Adam includes Adam's hands, close separation from God's hand in the fresco, which is believed by some art analysts and historians to suggest the unattainability of divine perfection by humans. There's also another of Michelangelo's works is David. It's one of the multiple sculptures called David, featuring David from the Bible, of course, that was created during the Renaissance. But this one is by Michelangelo. David portrays the biblical figure David, the Hebrew Bible's account of the king of the United Monarchy of Israel and Judah. The sculpture is 17 feet tall and 6.5 feet wide, and David is reminiscent of the ancient Greek sculptural form of heroic male nudity, so you can say that they just return to those classical norms, such as heroic male nudity. And in the sculpture, David's figure is, of course, idealized and, of course, nude. It's Koros, of course. Koros from ancient Greece. I think it's Karos, but yeah, still, same thing. It's the form of ideal male nudity, heroic male nudity. This is the same thing attributed to the sculpture of David, of course. The Vitruvian Man represents the, as one could say, the, and I quote, the proportions of the human body according to Vitruvius, Vitruvius being a Roman architect in the first century BCE. This was one of Leonardo da Vinci's least colorful yet most famous pieces, which represents da Vinci's concept, and I quote, da Vinci's concept of the ideal human body proportions. The work is black ink on paper, depicting a male figure with two superimposed positions, with writing both above and below the image. The proportions are mostly attributed to Vitruvius, but the limbs on the Vitruvian Man are of proportions da Vinci discovered himself after measuring male models in Milan, Italy. Of course, there are quite a number of notable artists from the Renaissance. I mean, if you think about, for example, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, you could come up with da Vinci, Donatello, Raphael, and Michelangelo. Those are the four Ninja Turtles. I actually was kind of interested in figuring those out just because of the Renaissance. I've never watched Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I've never seen it, never even really heard of it. I only know the turtles' names. That's it. But I just kind of found that interesting, how they name them after Renaissance artists. But of course, they are included, being some of the foremost artists, the preeminent, most grandiose artists of the Renaissance, of the High Renaissance, they must be included. But of course, we're going to start first with perhaps not the best Renaissance artist, but certainly the most recognizable, certainly the most famous, most renowned of the High Renaissance artists. Leonardo da Vinci is perhaps the foremost figure in the Italian Renaissance. His artworks were among the greatest works in human histories. Like, we saw The Last Supper, we saw Salvator Mundi, basically the most expensive painting ever, and of course the Mona Lisa. We've seen all of them, and they're all extremely recognizable paintings that had a lasting effect on subsequent art movements, and basically every classical art movement that deals with God can follow from Leonardo da Vinci, and of course Michelangelo as well. Leonardo da Vinci was likely the most intelligent polymath in human history. Not only did he create many of today's most recognizable artworks, but he conceptualized flying machines, solar power, the double hull, and made considerable discoveries in anatomy, civil engineering, hydrodynamics, geology, optics, and tribology. He was basically inventing things 400 years early. He was in the late 15th and early 16th century. He survived in that day, in those days. And yet he created flying machines. He conceptualized solar power. He made significant discoveries, that most of which he didn't actually publicize, in a multitude of different fields. He was certainly one of the most intelligent polymaths, if not the most intelligent polymath in human history. However, of course, as I said, many of his discoveries were never publicized, and for the most part, never really even revealed to anyone outside of himself. Some of Da Vinci's notable works include the Mona Lisa, Last Supper, The Vitruvian Man, Salvator Mundi, and The Virgin of the Rocks. Likely the greatest sculptor, but he may not be Da Vinci. He may not be the greatest even artist from the High Renaissance, but it is believed that he is still. He certainly probably is the greatest artist from the Italian Renaissance. It's debated, of course, between him and Da Vinci, but Michelangelo created some of today's most memorable artworks, many of which had significant, almost unparalleled influence on all Western art. Michelangelo is wholly responsible for the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, which was I first learned about the Sistine Chapel in fifth grade when we were reading a book that featured the Sistine Chapel. It was a book that got really kind of into religion. Even though we were in fifth grade, it did get pretty deep into religion. And that's how I first learned about the Sistine Chapel. And I've always been enamored with it, but I never quite saw it. My fifth grade teacher told me that, because he's been there, he told me that, back in fifth grade, he told me that when you look up at the Sistine Chapel, you can't look down. Everyone, their necks just hurt. The tops of their backs just hurt because they crane their necks all the way up, 90 degrees up, and they just stare at the pulchritudinous incredibility of that beautiful, I already said beautiful, something that means beautiful, of that incredible, I already said incredible too, it's truly an ineffable mural. Like, it's just a massive mural hung in this great vault of a beautiful chapel in the middle of Vatican City, one of the holiest, and if not, probably one of the most historic places in the world, in the center of Rome, the smallest country in the world. He told me that you can't look down. You just can't look down because it's so beautiful. What you're looking at is just so beautiful. And I've always been very inspired by that, by the murals. And of course, I didn't even really look at them until very recently. Of course, the Sistine Chapel features some of the greatest artworks ever created. The greatest frescoes ever created, including the creation of Adam. Some of Michelangelo's most famous artworks include Pietà, David, Moses, The Last Judgment, and of course, the creation of Adam. Michelangelo's work, which was able to instill awe in its viewers, led to Mannerism, or the late Renaissance. Another one of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and the third of the triad of brilliant artists from the high Italian Renaissance was Raphael. Raphael lived only to the age of 37, but he left a large body of work that made him the third of the prolific trio, as I said, of the foremost Renaissance artists. Of course, these are Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, and as I said, Raphael. The Apostolic Palace, or the Vatican Palace, contains the Raphael Rooms. These are rooms filled with frescoes painted by Raphael and his workshop. Raphael's greatest works are the School of Athens, the Sistine Madonna, and the Transfiguration. Sandro Botticelli was an Italian painter of the early Renaissance who had quite a poor reputation until the 19th century, when pre-Raphaelites, a group of English painters, poets, and art critics, rediscovered and re-stimulated his work. His three most famous works were Primavera, The Birth of Venus, and The Adoration of the Magi, all of which are at the Uffizi in Florence, Italy. The earliest of the Renaissance artists on this list, Donatello was a sculptor who was born in 1386 in the Republic of Florence. Donatello brought back the heroic, freestanding nude male sculpture that was once popular in ancient Greece with his sculpture, David. He actually was the one who brought back ideal heroic male nudity with David, with his own personal David. See, this is another thing. There were multiple David sculptures. There was Donatello's David sculpture, and then there's also Michelangelo's David sculpture. Of course, Michelangelo also built this sculpture known as David. But Donatello's foremost works included St. George and David, of course, and of course the equestrian monument of Gatta Maleta. Remember when we talked about how Michelangelo influenced mannerism, or essentially the late Renaissance? Well, the late Renaissance would be subsumed by Baroque art, an art style that dominated Europe after mannerism. And mannerism dominated Europe from 1520 to the end of the 16th century, so basically until the end of the 1500s. And the style, the Baroque style, which subsumed it, would be the preeminent, the most prominent art form in the Europe until the 1740s. As with other art movements, Baroque art originated in Italy, specifically Rome, Italy. The Baroque style was encouraged by the Catholic Church as a means to counter the bland, uninspiring Protestant art and architecture. The Baroque style conveyed grandeur, contrast, movement, tension, and drama, which worked to prosper awe in its observers, and oh, trust me, it's true. All of the themes in the Baroque style that were previously discussed will be examined as the style of Baroque Europe. A grandeur in art displays impressiveness in appearance or style. Scenes appearing of great size and impressiveness, no matter the size of the piece, have grandeur that appear grandiose, exceptional, almost intimidating, very large pieces. They're not large per se, but they seem large, formidable even. An example among many of grandeur in Baroque art is the Triumph of the Name of Jesus, one of my favorite murals, one of my favorite frescoes ever. It is a fresco on the ceiling of the Church of the Gesù in Rome, Italy. It was created by Giovanni Battista Gualli, or Galli. Art history and analysis aside, as I said, the Triumph of the Name of Jesus is simply impressive. In my opinion, it is the preeminent image of grandeur in Baroque art. A contrast in art refers to the arrangement of opposite elements, such as light and dark colors, rough and smooth textures, and large and small shapes, to blossom a feeling of interest, excitement, and drama in the painting and its observers. An element of Baroque art, a Baroque contrast to be specific, is the chiaro scuro, chiaroscuro technique, a technique that delineates the interplay of light and dark in paintings that depict dim scenes. The interplay of light and dark produces a dramatic, contrasting atmosphere in the painting. Many Baroque artists work to convey movement in their artworks. An example of movement in Baroque painting, in a Baroque painting, is the motion of Venus and Adonis in Peter Paul Rubens' Venus and Adonis, representing a scene from Ovid's Metamorphoses, during which I'm reading right now, by the way, during which Venus and Cupid pull on Adonis as he goes off to hunt, basically by leaving them. He's going off to hunt as in leaving them. Tension, as present in the famous ancient Greek sculpture Laocoon and His Sons, which is more agony than tension, but it was still tension, was a prominent feature of Baroque art. Tension was a profound element in sculpture, showcasing itself in, for example, Apollo and Daphne by Gian Lorenzo Bernini, which of course is another scene from Metamorphoses. It featured Daphne, as she was changed from human to tree in the climax of the story of Apollo and Daphne in Ovid's Metamorphoses. I actually just finished another book apparently based upon Metamorphoses. I should have probably read Metamorphoses first, but I read Metamorphosis. I like to call it Metamorphosis, but it's Metamorphosis by Franz Kafka, and I'll say I highly recommend it. It is very depressing. It was very depressing, but it was very good. It was amazing. It was an amazing book. I did not want to spoil even the beginning. You don't even want to hear the beginning. You just want to read it because it is a wacky, wacky book, but it is very good and it's not too long. It only took me maybe an hour to read, an hour, 15 minutes. And I'm not that fast of a reader. So it wasn't a really large book, but it's very good. Two examples of drama in Baroque art are The Rape of Proserpina, a sculpture depicting Persephone, which is not a rape in the contemporary sense, but is instead the traditional translation of the Latin word raptus, which means to seize or carry off, a raptus. And then there's also The Chair of St. Peter, and this is one of the most incredible dramatic pieces of art I've ever seen. It is a dramatic chair conserved in St. Peter's Basilica in Vatican City. And you'll never be able to find anything, you'll never even be able to go through all the Vatican stuff. There's just so much there. There are so many incredible works of art there. Some notable works from Baroque Europe include Las Meninas, a painting created by Diego Velazquez that incorporated the chiaroscuro technique, the technique of contrast and dark scenes used to convey drama. The phrase Las Meninas translates to women in waiting, just as the painting portrays. Apollo and Daphne, the sculpture discussed earlier, that communicates tension as Daphne is metamorphosed. Allusion into a tree. This is an allusion to Ovid's Metamorphoses, of course. That's another really impressive sculpture. I really loved that sculpture. It is a very interesting one. The Night Watch is a painting by Rembrandt that depicted a Dutch citizen militia as it is moving. It's another scene conveying movement. The Rape of Persephone, or really Proserpina, who is the same thing as Persephone. Proserpina was the Roman Persephone, essentially. This was a sculpture examined earlier that portrayed Persephone as she was taken away by Pluto, who is Hades in Greek mythology, to be led to the underworld. Some notable figures from the Baroque movement are Caravaggio, Alejandino, Rembrandt, Peter Paul Rubens, Diego Velazquez, and Gian Lorenzo Bernini. The Rococo style is a style of art, architecture, and decoration that originated in France in the 1730s as a counter to the more formal geometric style of French classicism. The Rococo, this is going to be very hard for me to pronounce, the Rococo style was highly ornamental and theatrical, incorporating asymmetry, scrolling curves, I like to consider them motifs that are similar to the things that some, including myself, use to hang ornaments on a Christmas tree, but in paint or attached to artwork, essentially. Gilding, which is basically by adding gold leaf or gold paint to a painting, that became pretty popular. In future movements, I can think of Gustav Klimt in the Art Nouveau movement. The Kiss by Klimt, I'm pretty sure that had gold leaf in it as well. That became pretty popular in the 19th and 20th centuries. White and pastel colors, so like light and with low saturation. Sculpted molding. And trompe l'oeil frescoes. I actually had to put a pronunciation bar on that. TROMPE-L'O. I don't know how to what the formal name for the letter is, but it's like O and E, the letter is combined, and the letters are combined, IL. So it's trompe l'oeil. It's a French term that I didn't understand for obvious reasons, but they also incorporated these trompe l'oeil sculptures, trompe l'oeil frescoes. It is a technique, the frescoes used a technique that basically deceived the eye. Actually, trompe l'oeil is French for deceive the eye. And it uses realistic imagery to create the illusion of a three-dimensional environment. Like you, for example, at the ceiling of a vault of some particular chapel, you have a really brilliant, incredible piece that is essentially deceiving you, causing you to think that the ceiling of the vault is much higher than you had thought. But obviously it's not, because it's not a three-dimensional picture. But if you search up some of these pieces, whether now or after you listen or whenever, you will find that some of them incorporate this really odd style of creating the illusion of three-dimensionality. The Rococo movement created pieces that exemplified the ideals of the movement. These were delicacy, gaiety, lighthearted and cheerful. Like, gay means to be lighthearted and cheerful. Gaiety, of course, lighthearted and cheerful. The noun form of it. Youthfulness and also sensuality. These ideals were a stark contrast from the tenebrous, grandiose, and often tense images from the Renaissance movement and the Baroque movement. Even so, Rococo art too was designed to awe its observers at first sight. The Rococo movement spread well beyond France, diffusing to Italy, Germany, Britain, and Russia. Notable works from the Rococo movement include The Swing. Oh, this was this is one of my favorite paintings. An 18th century oil painting that depicts a young woman on a swing against a magnificent, and I cannot even quote it better than saying magnificent. It is absolutely magnificent. A magnificent forested background. There's also The Embarkation for Cythera, a painting that portrays a fête galante, an amorous definition. Is the definition of amorous is showing, feeling, or relating to sexual desire, for some context. A celebration enjoyed by the French aristocracy after the death of King Louis XIV, the French king that reigned longer than any other ruler in recorded history, for 72 years and 110 days. There's also The Blue Boy, a full-length portrait of Jonathan Buttle, the son of a wealthy hardware merchant, and there is Diana returning from the hunt, an oil painting featuring Diana and three of her nymphs by a stream. Some notable figures from the Rococo movement are Jean Honoré or Honoré Fragonard, Antoine Watteau, Francisco Goya, and Giovanni Battista Tiepolo, Tiepolo, let's say that. I may be butchering these words again. I don't think I'm doing it as much as I was in the last series of episodes on prehistoric and ancient art, which I highly suggest you watch or you listen if you haven't yet. But still, there are, being that it is art history, there are quite a number of things that I'm inevitably going to mispronounce. So that is what it is. The neoclassical movement began around 1760 and peaked during the Age of Enlightenment, which was in the 18th century, of course. It lasted well into the 19th century, during which it competed with Romanticism and subsequent movements. Neoclassicism is still very much a thing. We still have neoclassical architecture is still very popular. Not as much so as it was in the 19th century, but it's still very popular. I mean, it's not quite Gothic architecture in popularity, but it's very popular. I mean, there's someone that lives nearby me that actually has, his houses could be considered neoclassical. It's very Greco-Roman like. Neoclassical architecture lasted well into the 19th, 20th, and even 21st centuries. The neoclassical movement began in Rome, Italy, following the rediscovery of the ancient cities of Pompeii and Herculaneum, both of which were buried in ash following the explosion of Mount Vesuvius. This rebirthed the craze over classical art that dominated the Renaissance, just not as much so. The movement later diffused throughout Europe as a generation of art students returned from their quote-unquote grand tours. Grand tours were trips taken by young men of wealthy expectations as they came of age. This generation of art students, they gained a new Greco-Roman ideals, which helped inspire that movement further, especially with the young, art-minded, wealthy people. That's inevitably it's going to become a movement. And it diffused to America and Russia following that. This is one of the first movements that really took its roots in America as well, that really kind of found inspiration in America. For example, the Capitol building, that's neoclassical architecture. The White House is neoclassical architecture. You could even say that most of the Capitol buildings state Capitol buildings are classical architecture, neoclassical architecture. So this movement, unlike other previous movements, really became popular in the United States. I mean, there were mainly as an architectural movement, though, of course. In Russia and the United States, neoclassical architecture would continue, especially in architecture, even long after European neoclassicism fell out of favor. The neoclassical style in painting took the style of Michelangelo, for there existed few paintings from classical antiquity, and we know why, because they were made out of wood. They were tiny, well, not tiny per se, they were like plates on which paintings were made, but those plates were wood, so basically all of them are gone. But neoclassical architecture took on that typical Greco-Roman architecture. So you'd have columns you'd have these really immense, formidable columns. You'd have Pantheon-esque architecture, basically, or Parthenon-esque architecture, with modern changes. You can see the difference between classical Renaissance and Greco-Roman architecture. You can see the difference from that and modern neoclassical architecture, no question. Although neoclassical painting and non-architectural art forms were not necessarily distinct from prior classical art movements, there are a number of notable works that resonate even into today. Some notable works of the neoclassical era include The Death of Marat, Jacques-Louis David's oil painting of Jean-Paul Marat, a French revolutionary who was assassinated by a young woman that claimed to have information on escaped political nemeses that had fled to Normandy. This was, of course, during the first. In the next series of episodes, you will see the next series of episodes on this, on art history. You will see that a lot of art movements tied in with French revolutions, because this is the first French Revolution. To be very specific, this is the first revolution in the late 18th century, but there are a number of there are quite a number of revolutions that would occur in the future. Many. French history could... I feel like French history might even be richer than U.S. history. even from 1776. There are other ones, though. Napoleon the First on his imperial throne, which was Auguste Dominique Ingres's oil painting of Napoleon Bonaparte in his coronation costume. There's the death of Socrates, Jacques-Louis David's painting of Socrates as he is executed. He had to drink poison as his execution. As told by Plato in Phaedo, I think that would be the fifth of the... I'm sure that's probably the fifth of the five dialogues. And the intervention of the Sabine women, Jacques-Louis David's rendition of the legend of the abduction of the Sabine women by the founding generation of Rome. Some of the famous painters of the neoclassical movement were Jacques-Louis David, who was featured in most of the notable artworks from the neoclassical movement that we discussed in this episode, Antonio Canova, Jean-Auguste Dominique Ingres, Andrea Appiani, and Anton Raphael Mengs. An artwork that particularly resonated with me was one of the foremost frescoes from the Baroque period, and we actually discussed this earlier. The Triumph of the Name of Jesus. It is a beautiful and bright mural that presented the illusion of three-dimensionality. The Renaissance era is so recognizable that most do not need a history lesson on it, but if you know of the many movements that the Renaissance laid the groundwork for, such as the Baroque, Rococo, and Neoclassical movements, which of course were analyzed in this episode, along with modern art movements that will be discussed in future episodes. My favorite art movement ever is going to be the first one in the next string of episodes. It's the Romantic movement. It's one of my favorite ever, including literature. Anyway, thank you all for listening, and as always, have a good morning, afternoon, evening, and night. Take care and stay curious.